You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld stated yesterday that the estimated cost to maintain the current level of force in Iraq is $3.9 billion per month, almost double the administration's April estimate of $2 billion per month. Speaking before the Senate Armed Services Committee, U.S. General Tommy Franks said that the current violence and uncertainty in Iraq have made it unlikely that troop levels will be reduced, quote, for the foreseeable future, unquote. Well, all of this has got Peace Watch commentator Clarence Page thinking, if Iraq isn't a Vietnam-like quagmire, it's a pretty close imitation.
Here comes that Q word again. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld wants you to know that we are not in a quagmire. Iraq is not a new Vietnam either. You got that? Nor are we fighting a guerrilla war there, even if our current police action does appear to fit the dictionary definition. So went Rumsfeld's recent response to a reporter who wanted to know whether persistent attacks on U.S. troops amount to guerrilla war or a Vietnam-like quagmire. Irritated, Rumsfeld asserted that wishful thinking might lie behind such questions. Quote, there are so many cartoons where people, press people, are saying, is it Vietnam yet, hoping it is, and wondering if it is, Rumsfeld said during a press briefing last month. And it isn't. It's a different time. It's a different era. It's a different place, unquote. Well, I hope I'm not hoping that Iraq is another Vietnam, as Rumsfeld asserts, when I see the comparison between the two. Quite the opposite. I hate to be right when I anticipate bad news. Bad news was what I anticipated when the Bush administration entered Iraq without a hint of an exit strategy or a plan for how the U.S. would manage the place once Saddam Hussein inevitably fell. And I was hardly alone. But instead of dealing with such pragmatic questions, the Bush administration and its defensive defenders accused the questioners of lacking patriotism or, quote, forgetting September 11, unquote, or being, worst of all, liberals, just for raising the question. Now the bad news that many of us questioners wondered about is unfolding. Dozens of coalition forces, mostly Americans, have died since Bush stood on the deck of the USS Abraham Lincoln near a banner reading Mission Accomplished on May 1st and said, quote, that major combat operations in Iraq have ended. Those who ask, have you forgotten September 11, also should ask, have you forgotten May 1? A lot of us already have forgotten the weapons of mass destruction, even though that was the Bush administration's main justification for entering the war. Now that purpose has become devalued by the administration and public opinion polls to the more noble humanitarian mission of saving Iraq from Saddam Hussein's brutal regime. Well, I'm all in favor of humanitarian efforts, but it is odd to me how the Bush administration, that did not think humanitarian reasons were enough to get us into Iraq, now finds that to be a sufficient reason for us to stay. The same is true of Afghanistan, where a U.S. soldier was killed in a vehicular accident and two other soldiers were injured by hostile fire a few days before Rumsfeld's little rant. We still have 10,000 U.S. troops stationed there, and more than 60 have died since America attacked the Taliban regime 20 months ago. If Afghanistan slipped your mind, you're not alone. Even the Bush White House forgot to include funds to aid and rebuild Afghanistan in its 2004 budget request earlier this year. Members of Congress remembered, and they inserted the allocation. The Bush administration also denies that Afghanistan is a quagmire. Heck, the administration even seems to have trouble remembering that Afghanistan exists. Rumsfeld is right to call Iraq a different time, era, and place from Vietnam, but old lessons still apply. Having just returned from a vacation in Rome, where the visitor instantly is immersed in a warm bath of 2,000 or 3,000 years of history, I was reminded by Rumsfeld's remarks of how great empires fall. One big reason is the H word. Hubris. The pride of great nations sometimes grows into an arrogance too big for their pantaloons. They extend themselves too far, spread themselves too thinly around the globe, and find themselves dragged under by too many entangling burdens. The Bush administration has not yet reached that level of hubris, but we can begin to see it from here. The administration's go-it-alone posture in Iraq is looking increasingly questionable. The rebuilding of Iraq should be internationalized as soon as possible. If the administration does not want to work with the UN, although the body is well experienced at peacekeeping roles, it should at least work more closely with NATO or the Arab nations that have offered assistance. If Iraq is not a quagmire, it offers a dangerously close imitation. My dictionary defines a quagmire as a soft, muddy surface, or a difficult or precarious situation, a predicament. Both descriptions apply to the choices that America faces in the Middle East. No, this is not another Vietnam. There is no jungle this time. Instead, there is much sand. If we don't share the burden of Iraq and Afghanistan's futures, either could turn into another Q word, quicksand.
Clarence Page is a columnist with the Chicago Tribune. His column is distributed by Tribune Media Services.
Our leader is a pious Christian
who says he's on a holy mission.
He wants us all to do our duty,
but guarantees his friends the booty.
He's a mumbo-jumbo man.
He's a mumbo jumbo man.
He's a mumbo jumbo man.
They set the rules for folks to live by.
You make them angry and you could die.
Each wants to lead us to salvation.
Though it may well destroy his nation.
That's the mumbo jumbo plan.
That's a mumbo jumbo plan.
That's the mumbo jumbo plan.
That's a mumbo jumbo plan.
The Mumbo Jumbo Man by the Compatriots. President Bush is expected to arrive in Nigeria sometime today. It's the final country in his five-country Africa tour. Bush was dogged by protests in South Africa, where he snubbed former South African President Nelson Mandela by failing to schedule a meeting with Mandela. But before Bush's arrival today in Nigeria, about 60 protesters taking part in an anti-American demonstrations were arrested in the city of Kano in the mainly Muslim north. Among Africa's most valuable assets is oil, and it's been estimated that as much as 20-25% of U.S. oil imports will likely come from West Africa by the year 2005. One of the main oil producers and also Africa's most populous country is Nigeria. Peace Watch spoke earlier this week with Daphne Wysham, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, about Nigeria's strategic importance to the U.S. and America's plan to send troops to protect its oil interests in the region. Here's part two of our discussion.
Of course, there's the story of Ken Saro-Wiwa.
That people
should be familiar with, although I'm amazed how few people actually know the story of the poet and playwright and activist and outspoken leader of the Ogoni people, Ken Saro-Wiwa, who was jailed repeatedly for his leadership role in the Ogoni community in pushing Shell and the other big oil companies off the land of the Ogoni people, which is a small area in the Niger Delta. They to this day, they have succeeded in keeping the oil companies off of Ogoni land. But under Abacha, there was brutal reprisal against Ken Saro-Wiwa, and he and his fellow leaders in the Ogoni community, nine people were accused of falsely accused of murder of some local political officials. And despite pleas for clemency from world leaders, including Clinton, were hanged in 1995. And shortly thereafter, the World Bank and all of these other financial institutions decided to pull out, but they didn't say it was because of Ken Saro-Wiwa's hanging. They said it was because of an unstable economic climate. And they have since returned with the election of Obasanjo in 99. However, shortly before Obasanjo was elected, there were two incidents involving Chevron in the Niger Delta where peaceful protesters who had gotten on some Chevron barges, had taken over the barges because they were upset over, you know, oil spills, no jobs, no source of income, no way to feed yourself because all the fish have died. And they took over these barges, and the officials there said, wait here, we'll bring in some Chevron officials who will come and meet with you to discuss your concerns. And instead they brought in the mobile police, or the kill and go, who shot and killed two people in the back and injured and tortured countless others. This happened again. This one was in 98, I believe, or 97. Happened again in another village, remote village, where we're not sure exactly how many people were killed, but they used Chevron helicopters and boats in both incidents. And those cases are now proceeding through U.S. courts under the Alien Tort Claims Act, which, of course, Ashcroft is trying to eliminate. But those are just some of the more newsworthy cases of human rights abuses that have occurred over the last 10 years or so. But an entire town, the town of Oti, was leveled under Obasanjo's watch because four police officers had been killed, and they came in and, in reprisal, leveled the entire town and shot every living creature that they could, including the chickens and the goats. And so this is the country that is being held up by the Washington Post and others as a model of democracy. Hmm. And I think we need to scratch the surface and look at why it is that it's in the interests of these banks, for example, to portray Nigeria as a country that we can deal with once again, because they're so eager to get at that oil.
Mm. And as we see President Bush visiting Africa and Nigeria as well, Daphne Wyson, what would you like for us to recall as we're looking at these, what some have said, photo ops of the president?
Well, I think what we need to be, holding our president accountable for, and our members of Congress accountable for, is the best way to move forward with regard to Nigeria is to support the calls for a real democracy on the ground by the people of Nigeria, and that includes calls for a sovereign national conference, for the different ethnic nationalities to sit down and determine their own constitution. That's the first step in building a democracy. We understand that here in this country, but for some reason we think that that would create civil war, and it's too much for Nigeria to handle. And so, you know, the State Department and others, that's going to be the last thing on their agenda. But that would be a critical first step, and then we absolutely need to hold our corporations accountable for their activities overseas. We need a stronger accountability mechanism. The Alien Tort Claims Act is weak, but it certainly shouldn't be eliminated. It should be strengthened. And then other efforts at transparency of oil revenues. Of course, that's a critical piece in all of this, so that we know that there's not bribery going on. And we need to be talking about alternatives in terms of energy supply in this country, because otherwise we're just going to be sending our military all over the globe to secure energy resources. And of course, people need to be letting their members of Congress know that they oppose the use of the deployment of U.S. troops to secure Nigerian oil. There will be hearings in September on this. And I encourage people to get in touch, in particular with Congressman Donald Payne, to register their opposition.
Why Donald Payne?
Well, he's playing a leadership role in the, I believe it's the Foreign Relations Subcommittee. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. He's active on this issue. We've met with him.
Is he supporting the U.S. corporations going into Nigeria?
when we spoke with him, he wasn't actually aware of, we spoke with his aides, and they weren't aware of the deployment of U.S., the planned deployment of U.S. troops to secure Nigerian oil. And so we wanted to make sure that people got the message to him that they're concerned about this. And he's a progressive in general, and is open to progressive issues with regard to Africa.
What role exactly is the World Bank playing in all this? How does it stand to benefit from these U.S. corporations going in?
Well, the World Bank has been pushing an agenda that dates back to the 1980s. We actually found these memos from the Treasury Department under when Reagan had recently assumed office, where the U.S. Treasury was basically saying that, look, we can't push an agenda that basically our agenda is to open up oil and gas fields in non-OPEC countries around the world. But we, as the U.S. government, cannot push this agenda because we would be suspect as the home to these oil majors, you know, Exxon and so on. So we would like the World Bank to push this agenda instead. We have this document up on our website. People can take a look at it at scene.org. So the World Bank then took its marching orders, because the U.S. is the largest shareholder in the World Bank, and what the U.S. asks the World Bank to do, it generally does, and began to push this agenda of diversifying non-OPEC sources of oil and gas for Western markets, and furthermore pushing an agenda of privatization and deregulation of oil and gas markets. Because as long as an oil company is nationalized, it can it's less easy to control. So that agenda has been front and center in Nigeria, especially since Obasanjo took power. As I mentioned, you know, the financial institutions like these elections to take place, like the like people to believe that there's a democracy in Nigeria, so that they won't get protests in the streets when they begin cutting deals with these leaders. And that goes for the World Bank. That's basically what the World Bank has been up to. They're also financing you know, oil services contractors and so on in Nigeria. They're financing this Nigeria to Ghana West African gas pipeline, which there's a lot of opposition to in Nigeria and in Ghana.
Daphne Wysham is a fellow at the Washington-based Institute for Policy Studies. Finally tonight, as the nation went to war in Iraq, cities across the country put themselves on the war resisters map with various demonstrations, anti-war resolutions, and creative peace protests. Among the more outspoken residents of one small California town is Utah Phillips, who hosts Loafer's Glories on his local community radio station, KVMR. Phillips keeps busy in his hometown, not only with his folk singing, storytelling, and gardening, but with his passionate peace activism. Last winter, a bold idea he had led to a significant action in his community. Peace Watch correspondent Carolyn Crane has this report.
My name is Utah Phillips. So it was sometime before that war began that I kind of flew off the handle. It takes a lot to get me mad, but that did. I said, damn it, if that war starts, I'm going to go sit down in the middle of Broad Street there at Pine Street in a chair with a sign and just sit there until I get arrested. Well, I guess that it was a couple of other people around me. It was Russ Jorgensen, you know, heard me say that. Said, well, I'll be there with you. And then it just kind of got bigger and bigger until finally we had a whole affinity group doing the nonviolence training for several months.
On March 20th, 2003, in the small Northern California town of Nevada City, several hundred demonstrators marched silently through the streets to protest the invasion of Iraq. An affinity group known as Crossroads sat down in the middle of the busiest intersection in town.
My name is Katie Walsh. I had heard that this shock and awe bombing phase of the war, they were going to drop more tonnage than was dropped on Hiroshima. And that landed in me like a lead weight. There came this no, this outrage that came from the bottom of my being that said no.
Walsh was one of the dozens of people who spontaneously joined the affinity group in the Crossroads. Another was John Cassatt.
Though I was sitting in the street, the First Amendment of the Constitution says that Congress shall make no law abrogating peaceable assembly for the petition of redress of grievances. If this wasn't a peaceable assembly for the petition of redress of grievances, I hardly know what one is. And in the interest of defending our sorely embattled Constitution, it was imperative to try to make clear that this is lawful behavior.
I'm Meg Pally. I'm a mother of six and a grandmother of 19 and a great-grandmother of six children. And they are busy with their lives and couldn't do things like this. I'm really healthy and free to do stuff. So I agree with Maggie Kuhn, who started the Gray Panthers, that it's the older people that should be taking stands.
I'm Mariana Greenberg, and we went to the march with my partner, Stephen, and my two children, Liana and Toby. They're 15 and 16.
I'm Stephen Greenberg. Of our family of four, I was the only one who was not arrested at the demonstration on March 20th. We made a decision that I would be, because I'm the only one with the driver's license, it would be pretty handy if I could drive around and be able to pick up the kids and Mariana from their respective booking areas. I'm a criminal appellate attorney. I essentially function pro bono as a legal advisor for all of the Crossroads defendants.
After sitting for over 2 hours, 42 people were arrested at Broad and Pine Streets. The charges against the two minors were dropped. The 40 adults were charged with two misdemeanors, unlawful assembly and failure to disperse. They were also charged with the infraction of not yielding a right-of-way to vehicles. They faced up to 6 months in county jail. One protester, Betty Earhart, died before the arraignment. She was 85. Her friends said that the war had broken her heart. At the arraignment, the district attorney offered the remaining 39 a plea bargain. If they pled no contest, the misdemeanors would be dropped and they would be fined the minimum for the infraction, $317. No protester was willing to pay the fine. Most, including Utah Phillips, opted for a community service project creating nonviolence curriculum for the schools. Four protesters who accepted the plea bargain chose to do jail time. Stephen Greenberg.
When 17 of the defendants decided not to accept the DA's plea offer and decided they want to exercise their right to go to trial, then I focused very heavily on researching the legal issues. I did the defendant's response to what we called the DA's duct tape motion, which essentially would have kept any defense evidence, any political evidence, any evidence of the defendant's motivation out of the trials. Their argument was that this would become a circus. Deputy District Attorney Pong alluded to the Chicago 7. He kept using the word circus, that the defendants just want their political soapbox. That's all that's going on here.
The 17 defendants were placed into three trial groups. In pretrial conference, the judges made clear that if the case went before a jury, they would enforce the duct tape motion. Because of this, the Nevada City 17, as they were now known in town, opted for bench trials and a chance to discuss their motivations for sitting in the Crossroads March 20th. Most importantly, the defendants wanted to discuss international and constitutional law. Of the Nevada City 17, one person pled out, one person was acquitted of all charges, and three were acquitted of unlawful assembly. Judge Darlington said to the local press that he was not high enough on the food chain to make groundbreaking legal decisions. Of those defendants convicted, all but two chose jail time in lieu of paying a fine or doing community service. Judge Darlington said he respected that choice, that it reminded him of Mahatma Gandhi.
In his final ruling, the judge referred to Thoreau, and he said, "You defendants may indeed be on the forefront of legal change." And he encouraged the defendants to appeal because he said, "We presented some really substantial legal issues that needed to be taken up to a higher court." He addressed one of the defendants, Mariana, my wife, and interrupted her closing statement to say, I just want you and all the defendants to understand, I do not think of any of you as criminals.
Katie Walsh.
I felt like what we were doing that day was civil obedience. And to stand up to the judge and say, no, I am not a criminal. I don't care if you want to jail me. I don't care what you want to do to me. I'm not afraid to lay down my body. We were told that we were polarizing the community, and maybe we did. But maybe that was needed because people had to, like, question. Here were 42 people. This is a small town. We don't even have a stoplight in this town. That's how small it is. And people had to stop and say, 42 people got arrested. What's that about?
Mariana Greenberg.
Those two steps I took to finally sit down were probably the biggest steps in my life. I mean, for me, I made a decision for the rest of my life to keep on sitting down or standing up or whatever I need to do to make change and to push myself as far as I can.
Crossroads 42 continues to function as an affinity group dedicated to civil resistance. For more information, contact Carolyn Crane at kvmr.org. Produced by Carolyn Crane for Pacificus Peace Watch.
Pacificus Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineers today were Scott Gurian and R.H. Brown. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammett of KPFA, Harmony Rising, Joya Jefferson-Nuri, Keith Chalgian, and Chris Novak. It's your financial support that makes Peace Watch possible, so we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.